Downsizing, decluttering, updating, redecorating, they're all reasons that someone might want to get rid of some items that are no longer useful or wanted. With the best of intentions, we often turn to thrift stores or charities when we want to get rid of things, thinking and hoping that our old items will find a second life somewhere else and that someone else will enjoy them. While that's true in some cases, our next guest found that on average, thrift stores only sell about 1/3 of the items they put on their shelves, and many things don't even make it to the public. Adam Minter wanted to find out what really happens to our things after we're done with them, so he spent years in the places where our cast-offs go, from an importer of used goods in Africa to the donation center of Goodwill. Adam's new book is called Secondhand: Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
You got into the core issues of this book after your own mother passed away, and you and your sister needed to deal with the stuff she left behind. And I think that's really a situation so many people can relate to. What kind of thoughts were you having as you went through that process?
Well, it's sort of the second period of mourning that, you know, those of us who live in consumer societies encounter. You know, after your parent is gone or your loved one or your friend, you are left with that material legacy. These things that may have mattered to your relative, but don't necessarily matter that much to you. And we reach the end of this process of cleaning out my mother's home and cleaning stuff out of garages of relatives where she had left stuff. And we found ourselves staring at her china, saying to each other, "You take it. No, you take it. No, you take it." We knew my mother loved that china, but we realized neither of us really wanted it or had space for it. So we decided we'd take it to a Goodwill. And as I was waiting in line to at a donation center in Minnesota to drop it off at a drive-through donation center, it occurred to me that this might be a good subject for a book, because we are not the only people to do this. And there's, you know, there was a lineup of people there dropping off things that they probably didn't know where it was going either. So it struck me as a very personal way that people could identify with, to get into the subject of what happens to all of our excess, because clearly our relatives can't handle all this stuff. So who's going to handle it?
Well, And as we said, many of us, for a variety of reasons, end up in this situation, whether it's someone else's things that are left or our own that maybe we need to downsize, or we're spring cleaning, right, or maybe we're moving for the fifth time and we realize we've been lugging the same stuff from residence to residence. We attach value to these things, whether it's sentimental value or we think that it's quote unquote worth something, but that's often pretty far from what the truth really is.
Right. And I think, you know, for me, going through this journey, not just of trying to figure out what to do with my mother's stuff, but watching what happens with all the stuff that's going through these donation doors, it was the sort of the revelation that the stuff that we have in our homes really isn't worth very much to anybody but to ourselves. You know, you may have paid $2,000 for that beautiful dining room table, but and it may have meant something to you and your family, and you have memories of Thanksgivings and all kinds of events around it. But the fact that you have sentimental value built into that doesn't mean you're going to be able to find somebody to pay $2,000 for it. Or for that matter, you may not be able to find a donation center that wants it, because there is such an excess of these beautiful tables out there right now, and they are out of fashion. And so that's where it becomes, you know, quite difficult, and you start to see how much of our identity is built around these things that that we, you know, we value so much and attach such powerful sentimental value to, but there's no correspondence to actual real value in the world, something that somebody else would buy. So it's all about what matters to you personally, but it doesn't really matter to, if you will, the market that's out there for stuff.
And one of the interesting aspects of this is tastes change, and things that were in style or in fashion and really kind of a status symbol for a generation or two ago just really don't fit in what we think of as a modern home often.
Right, exactly. And if you go, say, to any antique mall that you may have there in Wisconsin, you will find an excess of what's called in the business brown furniture. And I think we all know instinctively what that means when you say the term about brown furniture. It's just not in fashion anymore. And yet 50 years ago, people couldn't wait to get their hands on that beautiful oak furniture. And so it goes out of fashion, and suddenly people are buying things that have cleaner lines, and you have an entire antique establishment, if you will, that has to figure out where this stuff can go. And it's not just the big things, you know, like the big pieces of oak furniture. I mean, along the way of reporting this book, you know, I, I kept hearing about how Hummel figurines, and I think some of your listeners will certainly know what these small German porcelains look like, which, you know, would go for $300-$400 a few years ago. You're having a hard time getting $20-$30 for some of them anymore, because the people who love those things are passing on and the next generation doesn't want them. And so again, it becomes one of these situations where the absolute value of something, the monetary value, really isn't there when the sentimental value goes away.
We're talking with Adam Minter right now about his new book, Secondhand: Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. And Adam, one of the aspects of your book that I found the most interesting is that in the United States, a whole industry has grown up around this issue of people needing to clean out the homes of their loved ones, either when they move to, say, a care facility or when they pass away. And it's not just people who are dealing with the stuff. They are also dealing with their relatives who are wrestling with the feeling of getting rid of things that they feel like there should be something better to do with them.
Yeah, exactly. The move management industry, which, you know, in some sense probably has existed for centuries, the idea that somebody would help you clean out your home and take the stuff with them. But it's become formalized in the last 20 and 30 years. And there's actually an association of what's called move managers. And what they do is, yes, they'll come in and help you pack things up, but at the same time, they will sort of counsel you, you know, talk to you about your stuff, you know, especially older relatives who are very attached to the things that, you know, they've lived with for 50 or 60 years. That wedding china, you know, they may have that wedding china and several other sets of china. And so they will counsel them, literally counsel them on, you know, why this probably doesn't make a whole lot of sense to take with them. So I spent time with these businesses, and it can be really heartbreaking encounters that you see these move managers have, you know, with people. And it's not just in the United States either. Japan also has a similar industry, and they are facing some of the similar pressures that we have in the United States with an aging demographic that has acquired a lot of stuff through a very affluent period, and they can't take it with them, whether it means the senior housing or, you know, if they pass along, you know, they can't take it with them there either. So it's a very big industry, and it's going to grow, especially as the United States ages further and we see these very affluent generations trying to figure out who is going to get their stuff, where it's going to go.
And it's interesting, Adam, because it's definitely not, as you just said, an American problem. This also happens in Japan, European countries, elsewhere. But one of the biggest differences, it seems, is that Americans have more room in their homes to put more stuff.
Exactly. And that's the big difference is, you know, over the last 50 years, the American house has grown by almost the average American house has grown by almost 50%. Americans have gone through a period of incredible affluence. So they've been able to buy stuff to fill up those homes with. And the price of so many goods has declined. So those homes are filling up with stuff that, you know, that may have been valued by the person who bought them. But because the price of goods has fallen, the quality of goods has fallen. And so it's less desirable, if desirable at all, to somebody else who's looking to acquire it. So you have more stuff filling bigger homes that nobody wants. And that's becoming a real problem. And it's where these move managers and other services that are out there to help people downsize become really important.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Mike in Madison is up. Hi, Mike. Hello, Mike.
Yes.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi. So I am about to go deal with this same situation your guest was talking about, and I was wondering if you had some options for me. Unfortunately, the past 6 months with my father's dementia, he's gone on massive spending sprees. Fortunately, we've been able to catch a lot of it and return it, where he would buy like a microwave every day or buy things he thought he needed. And we've been able to return a lot of it, but we're finding things that he has secret stashed all over. And so I know you guys talked about giving away some of it, but unfortunately, in order to keep my stepmother in the home, we need to sell a lot of stuff. And I'm wondering if an auction is perhaps an idea. Or what I'm asking is there any options for the best way to kind of recoup some of the cost? Because he's run up almost $32,000 on credit card bills in the past 6 months.
And thanks for that call, Mike, and sorry that you're in that situation. Adam, I know you probably can't give very specific advice to Mike, but in your research, did you find some things that, seem to work better for people who are in that situation where they really actually need to recoup some of the value?
Yeah, it's really hard because, you know, as anybody who's ever bought a new car knows, when you drive that new thing off the car lot, the proverbial car lot, it loses a lot of value. And so recouping value is very difficult. The one thing I would say, I mean, you know, I found myself in this position. So it's very hard to go out there and say, I'm going to sell each and every item off. It's incredibly time consuming. And you got to measure, you know, how much your time is worth. But my advice then would be to find somebody, a clean out service, somebody who's going to go in there and take the stuff that nobody wants, as well as some of the valuable stuff, and you know, just face up to the fact you're going to take a loss on some of it.
So they'll go in, clear it out, and I think, remembering from your book, they will give you a price quote, but they will actually deduct a little bit for things that they feel that they can make some money on.
Exactly. I mean, the amount of time that goes into, say, doing an estate sale for most families isn't worth it, and they don't have enough stuff to sell in the first place. So the best option is to let somebody come in and just take the whole thing, and there'll be a fee involved, or maybe they will pay you something, but you're not going to recoup the value from everything, but at least you're going to have it off your hands.
We're continuing our conversation with Adam Minter. He's a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and the author of the new book, Secondhand: Travels in the Global Garage Sale. And I want to zero in on that global garage sale part of this, Adam. How is our thrift store and stuff market in the U.S. connected to markets all over the world?
Well, intricately. And if there weren't markets all over the world for our stuff, there'd be a lot more stuff not being reused, and a lot of it headed to landfills and incinerators. There's two really big areas that do go abroad and where there are markets for our stuff. The first is secondhand clothes. There's huge demand overseas for secondhand clothes from North America, and especially from the colder parts of North America. When you think about it, most of the world that's importing secondhand clothes are warm weather climates, and so they really like lightly worn summer clothes. So in Wisconsin, for example, you know, the summers are relatively short, and people don't wear their summer clothes for very long, so they tend to be in good shape when they go to donation centers. There's huge demand for that in places like Africa and Southeast Asia. The other set of, and so if it wasn't going there, a lot of it would not be going anywhere. It would be ended up in landfill. And the other area is electronics, things like computers, things like smartphones. Anybody who's traded in a smartphone recently knows that there's demand for it. There's value in it. And a lot of that value is coming from overseas, where people can't afford expensive new devices, a $1,000 phone. So they're willing to go back a couple generations, spend a little less, but at least it connects them to the internet and gets them online and sort of bridges that digital gap. So again, instead of that stuff being landfilled, although it probably wouldn't be landfilled, but recycled, it's actually reused. And that's overall better for the environment. And it's also better for our closets and desk drawers, because it means the stuff has somewhere to go. There's demand for it.
You do say in your book, Adam, that there's an interesting trend now that good quality clothes are actually getting less expensive, and that makes the secondhand clothing that often is of inferior quality less appealing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a big shift now in the global secondhand clothing trade because East Asian manufacturing in particular has become so good at making clothing so cheaply that new clothing, especially in developing regions, is competing aggressively against secondhand clothing. And so that means that the price of secondhand clothing on the global markets and demand for secondhand clothing in developing countries is falling off. And it's happening just at a time when people in places like Japan and the United States and Canada and Europe are buying more clothes than ever. We all know about the fast fashion phenomenon, you know, people buying essentially disposable clothing that'll only last three or four washes or three or four weeks, you know, in terms of fashion cycles. And so you're actually, that sort of thing combined with the drop off in demand in these developing countries means that there's more excess clothing that's going to have fewer places to go. And that's posing a real long-term structural challenge to organizations like Goodwills and Salvation Armies and other businesses that take sort of the middle market secondhand clothing.
We're talking with Adam Minter right now about his new book, Secondhand: Travels in the Global Garage Sale. And let's go to the phones. And Jeff in West Salem is up. Hi, Jeff.
Well, how are you doing this afternoon?
Good. What would you like to share?
Well, I know I've since I retired, I've, and even before that, I've been doing a little rummage sailing, you know, in the summertime. And the one thing that I've noticed is people don't, well, all the old timers are selling all their old tools, everything from socket wrenches to table saws and planers and joiners. And, you know, I think there's nobody that uses that stuff anymore, or very few people. And I think a lot of it probably just ends up going to the junkyard and sold as scrap prices.
And thank you for that call, Jeff. And Adam, that touches on a couple of things. You do talk specifically about tools, and also you grew up in a family of junkyard owners.
We did. I grew up in a Minneapolis, a small Minneapolis scrap metal recycling operation. And so what he says is true. I mean, as a young person who worked in that business, I saw a lot of these old tools come in, and he's absolutely right. This isn't just a recent phenomenon. It goes back a couple decades where we would get that stuff. There's no secondhand market, at least no immediate secondhand market for that stuff. And so it would be put into the bins that were sent to steel mills or you know, whatever type of metal it was for remelting. So you would lose that stuff. It's frustrating. You know, as I traveled the world looking at this book, I did find places that really did like those beautiful old hand tools, because those tools the gentleman just called about are beautifully made. I mean, they're very durable. But folks in the States in particular are just not using that stuff anymore. But you certainly can find people in Africa, for example, in Ghana and Kenya, where I've been, and you'd see that stuff there and they'd use it. But the trick is, how do you connect the buyers and the sellers? And so often that's the real difficulty is, you know, there may be somebody in northern Ghana who would love to get their hands on those tools, but it's, you know, how do we connect that person with somebody in Wisconsin who has them? And so in many cases, because it's so difficult and so expensive to move that stuff between the people who want it and the people who have it, it ends up getting recycled, and we lose that beautiful tool forever.
And Adam, you do advocate for things like the right to repair or labeling that actually talks about what durability you can expect from that. Would those be good steps in helping us avoid some of this waste?
Absolutely. Right to repair is a great movement, and I know you've had legislation introduced in Wisconsin to do it, which is just the idea that manufacturers have to share with consumers the documentation of how to fix their stuff. You know, if you buy a phone, an iPhone, for example, today, Apple will not let you see the repair documentation. Now, very few people are going to repair their own iPhone, but there's lots of independent businesses that would love to get access to that kind of documentation so they can repair it for you. And so if you allow people to get their stuff fixed, it's going to last longer. The other item that I've advocated for, you know, sort of dealing with some of these problems is just, as you said, something called durability labeling, which is this idea, which has been tested out in Europe, that manufacturers should have to put a sticker, say, on something that they make, saying how long that they expect it to last. And in many cases, especially with, you know, mechanical goods, say like a washing machine, or in terms of textiles like a shirt, they can tell you how many times they expect it to last in the washer, how many cycles they expect it to last when it's washing. And that kind of thing we found in Europe has actually helped people buy better for themselves. They'll spend a little bit more to get something that's going to last a little longer. And that's ultimately the goal, because we don't want people, you know, you don't want people buying lots of disposable things. It's not good for the pocketbook, and it's not good for the environment either. So if you can get folks to be buying on their own better, more long-lasting stuff, it's gonna benefit everybody and be one step, not the only step, to dealing with this problem of houses overflowing with stuff.
It can be really hard, even when you know that there's not a market for things. Let's go back to that old China, and we had a caller that we're not going to have time to go to saying, you know, isn't there maybe a historical society or something that would take it? What, Adam, in our last minute here, would you like us all to leave this conversation with in thinking about our relationship to items and stuff?
Well, I would say two things. One, I mean, it's really long past due for people to stop investing so much of their identities in the stuff that they buy. I mean, you know, I advocate, you know, when people buy gifts for people at a wedding or whatever it is, buy experiences. You know, at this point in human history, we're probably too far along to be spending our time investing so much in a set of china. You know, it's eventually going to end up, everything is ends up in the trash bin eventually anyway. Very, very little stuff, you know, goes on and ends up in a museum, a historical society. So keep that in mind about where stuff is going to go when you buy it, because ultimately it's not going to end up in that museum. And I think when you start buying and consuming with that in mind, you're going to make better choices and you're going to be leaving fewer messes for yourself and for your relatives.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us. It was a really interesting conversation and book.
Thank you so much.
Adam Minter is a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion and the author of the new book, Secondhand: Travels in the Global Garage Sale.